Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Rebecca Miller talks to me about documenting Martin Scorsese and directing her husband Daniel Day-Lewis, as well as being a judge at this year's Dublin International Film Festival. I chat to the two best friends, who also happen to be the writers and stars of comedy drama Sisters on RTE. Plus, Chris Wasser reviews all the week's new cinema releases, including the much talked about If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You. And your chance to win a family pass to the screening of new Disney and Pixar animated comedy adventure, Hoppers. You can email the show, screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all. And I do hope you're doing well. A regular listener, a friend of mine, you're all friends, but you know what I mean, said to me, why do you keep talking about the weather at the start of every show lately? It's just because I'm so wet every week, but I'm not going to start talking about the weather this week. There. This week in TV, I was watching this.
On America's Next Top Model.
We were showing the behind the scenes of what the fashion world was.
I wanted to fight against the fashion industry.
The only reason the door was open to me was because of Tyra.
We had an audience of over 100 million people.
I felt like I was part of something so big.
That was a moment where I realized, oh my God, I think we've built a monster.
There was a lot of body shaming.
You're not thin enough. You're not thin enough.
We are actually going to switch your ethnicities.
Ooh, baby girl, baby girl.
Things get crazier and crazier. Going to get a medical procedure as part of a makeover.
Look at my teeth.
Horrific.
There was a line that I feel was crossed.
He's grabbing my legs.
It was wrong, and for some reason, no one really seemed to see it.
It's a TV show to you guys, but this is my life.
I realized Tyra would do anything for the success of her show.
I knew I went too far.
Yes, now that is from the new, much talked about Netflix series, Reality Check, Inside America's Next Top Model. You may remember in the early noughties, America's Next Top Model was a juggernaut. I think it ran for 24 seasons. And it was the brainchild of Tyra Banks, the model. And supposedly the show was to bring diversity to the modeling and fashion world, but it soon became a bizarre show. And what this documentary uncovers is a show that, you know, only started 24 years ago or so, but it was very much a different time. And you can't believe they did some of the things that they did, the way the contestants were utterly shamed, body image, some of the bizarre things they did and some of the modeling shoots, like pretending to be dead, putting on blackface. And then awful things happened to some of these girls, one in particular on an infamous trip to Milan in one of the episodes. We have all the main players in this, Tyra Banks in particular, who doesn't seem particularly sad about some of the stuff that went down. She occasionally talks about regret, but there is a feeling from a lot of the people involved, hey, we were making a TV show. We did what we did. They have everyone. They also have some of the contestants who feel rightly bruised and battered by the whole thing. This is a pretty intriguing watch. It's three episodes. They probably could have done the whole thing in one big one for 2 hours. That notwithstanding, I do think you'll enjoy this as a piece of gripping TV about a reality show that was pretty horrific to the people involved. So as a piece of TV, a shocking but ultimately pretty gripping watch, that is Reality Check, Inside America's Next Top Model, now streaming on Netflix. Now we have a great competition this week in Disney and Pixar's all-new animated comedy adventure, Hoppers. Animal lover Mabel, voiced by Pippa Curda, seizes an opportunity to use a new technology to hop her consciousness into a lifelike robotic beaver and communicate directly with the animals. As she uncovers mysteries in the animal world, Mabel befriends charismatic beaver King George and must rally the entire animal kingdom to face a major imminent human threat, smooth-talking local mayor Jerry Generazzo. The all-star voice ensemble features John Hamm, Dave Franco and Meryl Streep. Hoppers previews on the 28th of February and on the 1st of March and opens in cinemas everywhere from Friday the 6th of March. Today on this very show, I have three family passes to give away. That's three winners in total to a special preview screening of Hoppers on Sunday the 1st of March in Dublin. So please don't enter unless you're available on Sunday the 1st of March in Dublin. But if you are, by all means do so to be in with a chance of winning one of those family passes to the screening of Hoppers. Simply tell me this: John Hamm, who is in the voice cast, starred in a famous TV show all about the advertising world. Was it A, Mad Men, or B, Mad Max? Was it A, Mad Men, or B, Mad Max? This is a text competition. Text will cost you 30 cents. So text the word movie, your answer, and your name to us now on 53106. That's 53106. Texting the word movie, your answer and name to us now on 53106. And text costs 30 cents. So why not enter and get along to a screening of Hoppers if you're one of the lucky winners? Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. We turn to some of the week's new cinema releases. Chief among them is the, well, Oscar buzz is possibly overstating it because it's just for Best Actress, and that's Rose Byrne in the film If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You. And we'll also be talking about Cold Storage, where Liam Neeson plays a man investigating fungus or something like that. To make sense of it all, delighted to be joined by regular reviewer Chris Wasser. Chris, hello.
John, hello. How are you?
Very well. So listen, good title for a movie. If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You. I've seen this. So tell us, Rose Byrne plays a mother pretty much at the end of her tether for various reasons.
Yeah, that's exactly it, John. And it's a great title, isn't it? Kind of the title, you know, when you hear that title, you don't really know what you're getting. You might be getting a drama, a horror, a comedy. And as it turns out, you're getting a little bit of all of that, I think. Rose Byrne is playing a woman named Linda, who is this very, well, you know, she's just completely run off her feet. She works as a psychotherapist. She is a mother to an infant daughter who is suffering from a medical condition that we're never really sure what it is. And part of the reason that that is because we never really actually see the child either. We hear the child. It's all, you know, close-ups of Linda throughout the film. We hear the child. The child is always beside her, but we never actually see her. And we'll come back to that a little bit later. But she requires a daughter, that is, a feeding tube at night, which is a complicated procedure that keeps Linda up all night. It's quite stressful. It's quite noisy and time-consuming. And you might be wondering, well, where's the other parent in all this? Well, it turns out that the child's father is a ship captain, and he's always away on business. So mom has been left at home to do all the heavy lifting.
But we do hear him shouting basic orders at her down the line.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I mean, that's kind of the thing in this film. It's a recurring theme where everyone is constantly trying to tell, you know, this mother what to do. And whenever she asks for help, they're kind of making out that she's not allowed to ask for help. And you might recognize the voice of the father. I don't think I'm really giving anything away if you've been paying attention to, you know, the marketing around this film, the trailers. It's Christian Slater. And we will eventually see him. But in terms of his voice performance here, it's very impressive. Now, if things weren't stressful enough for Linda and her family, the apartment starts to flood. The ceiling falls in and mother and child basically have to move out. And all she can really afford is an iffy motel across town. So it just adds to the stress. There she meets this superintendent played by A$AP Rocky, who offers assistance, but Linda kind of turns him away. It's almost like she's suspicious of anyone who might want to actually help her. She's drinking too much. She's smoking a bit too much. She's up all night. Her diet is all over the place. You know, it's just all donuts and cakes and pizzas. And then you think life might be a bit easier for her in the office where she's working with other therapists. But unfortunately, her closest colleague, who is also her therapist, probably not the best idea there, played by Conan O'Brien in a rare dramatic role for Conan O'Brien, he starts to question if Linda should find somewhere else to vent. So this is a person and a parent who needs an awful lot of help, John, and no one's really giving it to her.
Yes, indeed. And a couple of things there. Firstly, Conan O'Brien, very much against type, I would suggest. I mean, he's quirky, but he's quite serious in it. Brilliant casting, it struck me as, but what was your take?
Yeah, I love the casting in this. A$AP Rocky as an actor hasn't really impressed me before, but here I thought it was quite an understated role, quite charming. You know, he's required to play someone who, as I say, is pretty much the only person who kind of sees that there's something wrong here and that, you know, I might be able to help. Now, the help that he's offering is to, you know, buy Linda drugs on the dark web, which is probably not, you know, what she needs at this moment. But still, it's, you know, he's someone that she could turn to if she wanted to. Conan O'Brien, absolutely playing against type. It's a rare dramatic performance for him. You know, you think of Conan O'Brien, or at least I think of Conan O'Brien, I think talk show, Simpsons, comedian. You know,
funny one at that.
Fantastic. And also the best host that the Oscar has had in years.
Yes.
And he's hosting again this year. Wouldn't it be funny if Rose Byrne won? We'll come back to that. But I thought he was very good here. I mean, his character, the therapist that he's playing, is quite odd. A little bit, you know, just a little bit eccentric. It wouldn't be, you know, a Conan O'Brien performance if he wasn't. But I'd like to see more from him dramatically. But this is the Rose Byrne show. Coming out of this film, I just thought to myself, Jesse Buckley actually has some serious competition. Because I've been hearing that, you know, Rose Byrne was the closest thing that, you know, Buckley had in terms of a real competitor in the Best Actress category. So it's nice to finally watch this performance now and go, you know what, I think she is. And I think if Buckley was to lose, and I don't know if she will, I think she will win, you know, that Oscar. But if she was to lose to Rose Byrne, John, I don't know about you, but I sit back and say, okay, that's all right. It's not as if, you know, it went to another performer who actually didn't deserve it. This is a wonderful performance.
Absolutely. I think our countrywoman has it.
Yeah.
But if she were to lose, you know, you couldn't really argue because she's brilliant in it. And I suppose there's some slight parallels. I mean, they're both playing mothers going through things, albeit Jesse Buckley's character goes through significantly more, but there is a similarity there. It's quite anxiety inducing though, isn't it? Rose Byrne has calling her patients, her daughter who's has some nameless illness, her hole in her roof, her husband.
Yes, anxiety inducing should be on the poster. It's written and directed by a filmmaker named Mary Bronstein, who wasn't on my radar actually before I watched this. Made just one other feature in 2008 called Yeast. Hasn't made a film since. But if you look at the circle, you know, of the people around her in terms of her husband, Ronald Bernstein, who, you know, is an editor and works very closely, an editor and a producer, and works very closely with the Safdie brothers. Mm-hmm. Josh Safdie is in here as an executive producer. Those guys make films that are all close-ups and close calls and arguments and tantrums that are very stressful, that play out almost like fever dreams. This is exactly like that. You know, I saw one critic say that this was almost like, you know, Uncut Gems, except, you know, with a mother figure. And, you know, I salute that critic because I wish I'd come up with that. It is very much that. We are following Linda day to day, you know, from the moment she wakes up, having had very little sleep because of, you know, all the stuff that she has to do during the night and also the alcohol she's consuming, to, you know, the drop-offs at the hospital, work where she tries to park her problems and listen to other people's, back to the hospital, back to the motel, over to the apartment to see how the contractors are getting on.
You're making me tired just listening to you, Chris.
So stressful. But you know what? The reason I mention all of that is because, you know, listeners might be thinking, well, that just sounds like an experience I don't want to, you know, see. But it's actually very entertaining because of the performance, because of the writing, and also because Mary Bronstein starts to, whether or not it's anything to do with the fact that the character's sleep deprived, Mary Bronstein starts to actually include a horror element. I won't go too much into it, but let's just say that Linda's starting to see things and starting to question what's real and what's not. And I love that element of it.
Yeah. So you really like this. I really liked it as well. I had two quibbles and I just want to sense check them with you.
Okay.
Firstly, one thing I didn't like about it was we have this parent and all these people are demanding on her and her child, who, as you say, we never sees and has some condition which is, you know, seriously causing her and her family problems, is constantly at her. I want this. She's cranky. I mean, she sounds cute and all, but she's a very demanding child. And I have plenty of experience of that. But I find that in life and in movies, when you have demanding children, what makes it all worthwhile is, albeit a 10-second mommy, I love you, or thanks for making me toast, or whatever. And at no point in this movie does the kid give anything back. And that kind of, I needed a tiny bit of love from the child for the mother, a pass from demanding. Now, maybe that says more about me. And the other thing, I was with it the whole way. I just felt, and we're not giving any kind of spoiler, but we can talk about it in generalities. I didn't like the very end. I thought it was a bit of a, we've come this far, I want more. Discuss the above.
I would have been, in terms of the ending, I agree. I would have been happy, actually, if it had cut 2 minutes before the very scene.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. There
okay.
is. Yeah.
We're in complete agreement with that. The child showing a bit more love to Rose Byrne.
The child showing a bit more love to Rose Byrne. I love that decision that you only hear the child and never see it, because you know if you have a nagging child, if you were to then do a close up on that nagging child, you'd realize, well, this child is just adorable.
Yeah.
And this kid, you know, how can I be angry at a face like that? So by removing that adorable face, you do get annoyed, and you're always on Linda's side. So yeah. I think that was maybe a conscious decision that we need to make the kid sound like, you know.
But should the kid not have said thanks once in a while, just to, you know, humanize it a bit?
Oh, well, that would have been nice, but I think that's probably the whole point of it, that nobody really appreciates all of this work that she's doing.
Yeah. Well, this is saying more about me than you. Okay. But I did largely enjoy this immensely. So what are you going to say stars-wise for If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, which is in cinemas and getting a pretty wide-ranging release from this Friday, which is the 20th of February.
Yes, a wide release for this film, and it certainly deserves it. Watch it on a big screen. A film with that many, you know, close-ups is designed to be seen, you know, on a big screen as possible. I love this. I thought Byrne was just superb, the best she's ever been. I mean, she's always brilliant, but this is her moment. And I think she's fantastic, again, as a parent who just isn't allowed to ask for help. So that part of it is devastating, but also it's exhilarating cinema. It's thrilling. It's sometimes terrifying. It will stress the hell out of you, but I promise. Worth it, 4 stars.
Yeah, I'd largely go along with that. I think I give it 4 as well. And another thing I really liked about it, before we take a quick clip, is I had no idea where it was going to go.
No.
Like, it's a very original plot and screenplay, it has to be said. So that is 4 stars from myself, but more importantly, from Chris Wasser for If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You. Let's have a little flavor.
And if it doesn't, then something about not getting the tube out and reassessing the level of care. I mean,
tonight,
what do I do?
I would like you to get a good night's sleep.
So would I, but I'm asking you a thing, an actual thing, a problem to fix, that I need help with this. Am I supposed to just sit around and watch her fail and this is just going to go on forever? What do I do?
Okay, that means there's no drinking, there's no drugs, there's no...
I can hear you listening to me! Can you hear me? I'm asking you what I'm supposed to do!
A clip there from If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, which Chris Wasser gave 4 stars to. Now, Chris, the other big release of the week is Cold Storage. Liam Neeson battling mushrooms. I'm being facetious, but tell us more.
Yeah, there's a film that you want to see, absolutely. The enemy in this film is indeed parasitic fungus from space. And that fungus, you might be asking, well, okay, well, where is this fungus from? It came down with the Skylab space station. So we start with this prologue in the late 1970s. Skylab is coming back to Earth, re-entering the atmosphere. Some debris lands in Western Australia. And we learned that we actually sent some fungus up into space, but when it came back, there was something else in it. So some farmer, we're told, tries to turn that debris into a tourist attraction, and that goes about as well as you'd imagine it would have gone. So the Pentagon's cleverest bioterror chiefs, Robert Quinn, played by Liam Neeson, and Trini Romano, played by Leslie Manville, wonderful together here, they're called in to clean up this mess before it gets any uglier. It does get a little bit ugly, but, you know, look, the town is incinerated. They're all told to forget about what they've seen. A sample of fungus is sent off to some cold storage vault in America, and I'd like to tell you that everyone lives happily ever after, but that's where, you know, events, you know, are brought into the present day. And we then meet a couple of curious night guards, played by Joe Keery and Georgina Campbell, who work at this self-storage facility in Kansas. You can see where this is going.
Yes.
They're working the late night shift. They start hearing these odd alarms coming from behind the wall at work, and instead of ignoring them, because how can they break through the wall, and they discover that the government actually sealed away humanity's biggest threat in this secret vault. They built over it, and all these years later, the fungus is now ready to spread. And if it does, it's game over for everyone. So who do you call when fungus starts spreading and turning people into zombies? Big Limo.
So presumably Big Limo, Joe Keery, and Georgina Campbell try and stop all this. Is this a B-movie horror comedy?
It is, yeah. It's sort of a jokey B-movie horror slash sci-fi, which is actually based on a novel by David Koepp, who is, you know, look, he's the man who co-wrote Jurassic Park in Mission Impossible and some of the most famous and also profitable franchise in cinema history. I think he's like the second or third most bankable screenwriter in Hollywood history. David has adapted his own novel, working with a British director named Johnny Campbell. Johnny Campbell being the man who actually gave us that. Remember that Alien Autopsy film with Anthony Deck 20 years ago? Yeah. What a sentence. I don't think I've ever asked anybody that, John. But yes, this is the man who tried to build it.
I think of it often, but
this is the man who tried to build a jokey sci-fi around Anton Deck. So it is quite goofy. It is a little bit scrappy. I would also say it's unforgivably chatty because it's constantly telling you, you know, what's going on. And it also has Joe Keery just, you know, talking nonstop, but that is a part of his character that other people complain about here, so I will let them off. It could do with some sharper jokes and also some bigger scares, because I was thinking to myself, as a horror, it's not quite freaky enough, and as a horror comedy, it's not quite funny enough. But it's the performances here that really elevate the material. I thought Keery and Campbell were good value. Keery, obviously, you know, Steve from Stranger Things, you know, he doesn't even have to try to be charming. You just want to see him survive. You like his company.
Yeah.
He and Georgina Campbell are very good. They sort of have this, you know, will they, won't they romance thing going on. I think Limo does, you know, and I'm going to keep calling him Limo.
Yeah, I was going to say, first Naren Bass.
We're very familiar here. I think he does what he needs to here. In other words, you know what you're getting, but I will say though, I like this new phase that he seems to, and he's been in it before, where he's playing the action hard man, but he's also taking the mick out of himself. And I think he's better at doing that at this point rather than just sort of playing the same straight revenge role, you know. And also he gets to have like another threatening conversation over the phone here. Those are always fun. And I think also
he's sending that action motif man in his 50s up slightly, is he?
Oh yeah. And I wonder now.
Not slightly.
I wonder now actually if it's a man in his 60s or 70s. I mean, there is a scene in this film where poor, and I'm not giving anything away, but poor Liam Neeson hurts his back, or at least his character does, and he starts taking out people with his machine gun while lying on his back. So it's probably the easiest paycheck that Liam Neeson has ever picked up.
Okay.
But I liked him here. And also a special shout out to Dubliner Aaron Heffernan. We're seeing quite a bit of him now. He's also in These Sacred Vows, and he's in Cold Storage as the ex-boyfriend or the father to Georgina Campbell's kid in this film, who comes down with an awful case of the fungus zombies, let's say. So he's quite funny here. It's not the best thing I've seen so far this year, but it's also not the worst. And I do think, you know, I know that's faint praise, but I do think it is going for the late night cult movie status, and I think it'll get there.
Okay, so what would you say stars-wise for Cold Storage, which is also in cinemas from this Friday?
It's a bit of fun, and we're done in about 90-odd minutes, so you know I like that, John.
Yes.
We're going with a solid 3 stars.
3 stars for Cold Storage, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 20th of February, and 4 stars for If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You. Chris Wasser, thank you very much.
Thanks, John.
Up next, Rebecca Miller. Now, as you may know, the Dublin International Film Festival has started and runs until March the 1st. And as always, there are lots and lots of films to feast on. One of the awards that the festival gives out is the Avalon World Cinema Award that champions global filmmaking. The 8 shortlisted films will be shown as part of the festival. One of the judges of the prize is the acclaimed director, actress and writer Rebecca Miller, whose previous movies include Personal Velocity, The Ballad of Jack and Rose, and most recently she directed the amazing documentary that we raved about on this show, Mr. Scorsese. I'm delighted to say, by the power of intertechnology or something like that, we go live to New York, where Rebecca Miller is standing by. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning.
So, Rebecca, I don't kind of mean this as facetiously as it sounds, but why be a judge in a competition like this?
Well, you know, I have a warm spot in my heart for the Dublin Film Festival because I came with Personal Velocity in 2002. I don't think we had won Sundance yet, or maybe it had just happened, but it was a really, you know, I didn't know what was going to happen with that film. And it was a really big moment for me, and it was great. having the film at the festival. They were so sweet to me and so kind. And I have a very strong connection to Ireland. I live there part time. We've spent a lot of time there, raised our kids there part time. Mm-hmm. So anyway, when they asked me, I said yes.
Excellent. We're awfully glad that you did. And, you know, when you sit down and watch these 8 movies for Diff, is part of you thinking, like, I often wonder choosing a movie, is it, you know, are you thinking, God, I can see the labor in this. I can see where they might have got this idea. Or are you just a viewer, like, it hits you with an emotional punch, whichever movie you decide is the best?
Well, I definitely get kind of hypnotized into movies. You know, I definitely am available to be entranced. I don't get hypnotized by every movie. I feel like I'm not always, the first time I watch a movie, I'm not always unpacking it technically. In fact, I think if I'm really paying a lot of attention to how great it is technically, it's often failing on some other level emotionally, or it's not casting the spell that it would want to be casting. So generally I tend to try to, you know, especially when you're in a jury, you have to kind of keep that sort of judgmental part of you, because you are a judge, idling in the back of your brain. And you have to be thinking, okay, so how innovative is this cinematically? Is this visually interesting? I tend to be very attuned to falseness in acting automatically. I have a kind of allergy to that. So that automatically kind of throws me off my horse. But I love movies that surprise me and that where I really didn't know that where they were going. One of the things that is so exciting about being a judge for this particular Avalon Prize is that you get to see voices from places that I'm not watching film. You know, there's an African film that was, you know, and it's just a world I just don't know. It's a completely different world and feels so exciting to sort of enter that. Or a Chinese film. There are various films that were really windows into worlds that I didn't know, and filmmaking sensibilities that I don't see all the time. So that was really exciting.
And look, we will find out what you and the other judges, including Aidan Gillen, picked as the winner in the coming weeks. You mentioned surprise. I'm sure you hear this all the time. I'm a massive Scorsese fan, but I was surprised by your fantastic documentary for lots of reasons. And we should say it's still up there for anyone to watch. But I was surprised by how candid he was, whether he was talking about, you know, drug abuse, his own family life. Were you surprised by how much you got from Martin Scorsese? Maybe you weren't.
Yeah, no, I was. I mean, I didn't know Marty that well. We knew each other a little bit socially going into it. He knew my work quite well, really very well, it turned out. Had also read my books. So, you know, when I came to ask him if I could do it, it took a little, you know, I had to write a letter, I had to have a meeting, and so on. But once we started, I think in his heart, he just decided, look, I've avoided this for so many years, because of course, a lot of people asked him about doing a big film on him. And he just decided this was the right moment. Mm-hmm. And he threw himself in and was honest in the way that he is when he makes his own films. You know, he decided to be honest with me. I think also, you know, it was really just the beginning of the pandemic. And it just so happened that the pandemic began just as we decided to do this film. Okay. And there was something about being so isolated, so bored, and so cut off. It really threw him, I think, back into his own past and made him think about it in a different, perhaps, you know, gave him more time to think about things.
Yeah. And sorry, I don't want to nerd out here on Scorsese movies when I'm talking to Rebecca Miller, but I was also so surprised by finding the guy, or someone tracked down the character who Johnny Boy from Mean Streets was based on. Was that a lot of digging, or did someone just come one morning and say, we found him?
No, it was literally, you know, so Marty has spoken about his really close friend whose name was also Uricola, whose last name was Uricola. And Sally Gaga was a famous character that was appeared in the film before Mean Streets, which Who's That Knocking? And Robert Uricola, the older brother, as I said, had been mentioned. And somehow I read or something that Sally Gaga's real name was also Uricola. So I asked Marty, because Marty was talking about this sort of mythic character from the neighborhood that nobody could understand how he got away with the stuff he got away with and so on. And I said, is that Robert Uricola's brother? And he said, yeah. So then I had arranged to meet Robert Uricola, but nobody ever thought that I could meet Salvatore, Sally Uricola, AKA Sally Gaga, because he was just this almost like a unicorn. Like nobody ever thought to even ask. And that's when I say it's all genuine in Mr. Scorsese in the series. I say, I'm so sorry we can't meet your brother. And Robert says, oh, I'll call him. And he was literally 10 minutes away at the marina and showed up. And it was so weird. I was completely unprepared. The only thing I could think of was to ask him if he'd ever blown up a mailbox, which is of course a famous moment in Mean Street, and then you'll see his answer. But so it was pretty crazy.
Yeah, they're the phone calls I imagine documentary makers dream of. The first movie of yours I ever saw was The Ballad of Jack and Rose. I remember sitting in the cinema watching it. And I wonder, looking back now, the genesis, because you wrote that as well, was like, that was 2005. I presume you wrote it slightly before that. That was slightly before we had gotten as green and as environmentally conscious as we are now. And yet it's the story of this guy, in essence, living off the grid on an island. When you wrote that, were you trying to tell a human story about kind of lost souls? Or were you trying to write something about, you know, the looming crisis in the environment?
Oh my God, it's so, you're the only person who's ever asked me this question. Started that.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Great thing, I'm so happy. So I started that film 10 years before. I started writing that 10 years before I actually got it made. It was partly because it took me so long to figure it out, partly because I couldn't get it made, I couldn't get it cast. I offered it to my husband, Daniel, but I didn't know him at all then. And he turned it down. And later we got married. And then I asked him again a few years later. He had two children.
Things had changed a bit.
And, you know, I think he felt he'd aged into the part. But anyway, that came from my own obsession as a young kid with the environment. Like I grew up, you know, partly in the 70s and early 80s, but in the 70s, like it was a big, the environmental movement was very much in the center of people's consciousnesses. Okay. And I was very, you know, very concerned about pollution and land use and destroying trees and stuff like that. So that came from my own early obsessions. And also my older brother was a hippie and lived on a commune. And so I had always romanticized and been fascinated by those people. Mm-hmm. You know, I missed that period of time because I was a child, but I got to observe it sort of from a child's point of view.
So you were reimagining the hippies you never got to be, I guess. Fascinating. You might be better placed than anyone to have a view on this. You are very famously the daughter of, you know, this playwright who was part of 20th century culture in the way maybe no other playwright was, in the form of Arthur Miller. You're married to a famous artist you mentioned there, Daniel Day-Lewis. Your own children are now artists of varying kinds. Did you have no choice but to grow up in and become an artist yourself? I guess it's a long way of asking you, where do you stand on nature versus nurture? When you look at your family dynamic, you can't help thinking there must be something genetic, but maybe it's environment.
Yeah, I think all, you know, like you often see clusters of doctors in families or scientists. You often see people who are very, very generous in families with themselves. You know, you see like people who are firemen or, you know, EMTs in families. Like, so I think to some degree it's taught. These things are taught, of course. Like, you know, early on I was watching Eisenstein movies, you know, projected from a 16 millimeter projector on New Year's Eve, you know, that was like New Year's Eve, you know,
choice did you have?
What?
I mean, no wonder you became a filmmaker.
Well, yeah, I mean, like it was very early, but you know, I had interest. Like there was a moment I wanted to be like a nurse, for example, but okay. I wasn't really very good at anything else. Like I think that there were times where I dreamed of other careers or whatever. And I was a painter. I didn't think I was going to be a filmmaker, but I think generally being an artist, it's got to be a mix. And I think for the kid who leaps away, whether it's that their family are doctors or their family or whatever they are, to leap away and like start a new branch of the family is a very brave thing to do and very, and actually quite unusual, you know? So like the fact is that we've been artists for generations in my family and in both of our families. And I think it's probably a combination.
And listen, I mean, you had your book Total out a couple of years ago. You've just done the Scorsese thing. Can I ask what's next?
Well, I'm working on a couple of things. Like over the last couple of years, I've spent, you know, swathes of like 8 months at a time working on a new novel, which I have no idea when I'm really going to be finished with it because it's quite large. So that's one thing that I would love to, you know, complete. And then I have two screenplays, one of which is sort of like starting to move, I think, toward possibly something that I could make next year. I'm really in kind of a writing mode and I'm trying to get going with some stuff.
Okay. And then very finally, I tend to ask this a lot, but of people who've been around a while, and don't take that as a criticism or anything. Are you worried about the state of movie making? Like I hear horrible things about people putting stuff in movies now to remind people of what the plot is because they're on their phone so much, the streaming wars. You're more aware of this stuff than I am, but what's your sense of the future of cinema making? I know that's a very grandiose, but how are you feeling about the future?
Look, I mean, I've always considered myself to be a bit of an outsider as an artist. Like I was sat down and told that independent film was dead the first time about 30 years ago. Okay. Then I was told 20 years ago, it's been going on and on. I do think that individual voices are going to find a way of getting heard. And the truth is that we have to try more than anything to stay ahead of AI, to stay original, to make our own stuff. But the truth is that, like, you know, one of the things that's been so heartening is that the response to Mr. Scorsese, which is the title of this thing that I made on Scorsese, is so immense, like in terms just in the business, but also more just people are watching it and thinking, you know, why are they interested in this? You know, of course he's a famous filmmaker, but also there's something about him, the level of risk and the level of like how he just gave himself completely to his art. We're hungry for that as people. Yeah. I believe that as long as there are human beings, like we'll still have something to say and we'll still have people who can concentrate long enough to to digest what we said.
Indeed, indeed. Well, if you're looking for new voices, there are going to be 8 fantastic films shown as part of the Avalon International Film Prize at this year's Dublin International Film Festival, where one of the judges will be the lady I've just been talking to, Rebecca Miller. Rebecca, thank you for taking the time. It's a delight to talk to you and continued success.
Thank you so much, John. Thank you.
Rebecca Miller there, talking to me about her life and times and, of course, being a judge in the Avalon World Cinema Award at this year's Dublin International Film Festival, which is now in full swing. Up next, the two best pals, who are also stars and writers of the RTE series Sisters. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talks, TV and Movie Show. Now, 2 years ago, or maybe even 3 years ago, I remember telling you to watch Sisters, which follows two women, one from Canada and the other from Ireland, who discover they are half-sisters. They embark on a road trip to find their alcoholic father. It stars real-life best mates Susan Stanley and Sarah Goldberg as Suze and Sarah. And Susan and Sarah also wrote the show. As you may know, season 2 returned to RTE last month and the finale is on next week, and indeed all episodes are now available on the RTE player. Season 2 sees the action move to Canada, where having somewhat fallen apart at the end of season 1, the sisters are reunited as Sarah is about to get married. lost fathers, fertility, and romance are all at play in season two in what is a very funny and charming show about the power and pain of family relations. I'm delighted to say that we go live now to London, where Susan Stanley and Sarah Goldberg join me, respectively. And in the interest of full disclosure, I should mention that I grew up about four doors away from Susan Stanley, or maybe she grew up four doors away from me. Let's find out.
Hi, how are you, John?
Hi, John.
I'm very good. I'm very good. Sarah, never work with animals or friends. You're best mates in real life, right? Working with best mates, you know, that's one thing. But writing a show together and then starring in it, getting it off the ground, having season two, had you any reservations about, you know, I'm going to do all this with the person who's my best pal?
That's a great question. Well, to be honest, we've always said whatever happens with the show, our biggest triumph is that after all of it, we're still best friends. Yep. So through thick and thin. Honestly, it was such a gift because we've got a real shorthand with each other. And the process of writing the first season kind of came quite organically to us over probably too many bottles of wine. And we'd wanted to write something together for years. And so when we finally came to it, we were delighted that it kind of came with some ease. And acting together, the main challenge is not laughing because we both know it sets each other off. So one little twinkle in the eye and we've lost half a day. But yeah, we really, really enjoyed working together. Running a show together and producing together was a whole different story.
Yeah. We definitely had our moments. And look, season one was a baptism of fire. You know, it took us 6 years to write six episodes. And, you know, it takes a long time to make a TV show. And then when we were doing it, we were first time showrunners, producers, you know, writing every word, casting, and then filming. And it was incredibly intense.
Yeah.
And you know, yeah, there were a few moments where there was some tricky conversations.
The good thing is we always say we're like whack-a-mole. We never both go down at the same time. One always pops back up. So yeah.
But you know, we recovered and made a season two.
We did. And we're still speaking to each other. We're sitting next to each other right now.
Fantastic. Yeah, whack-a-mole. That's a good one to describe certain relationships. One is up and one is down. I like that. I may steal that. So, Susan, I haven't seen you since the 1980s or something like that. There's trauma at the center of this, as there are in most stories. But when you sat down to write this together, and I don't want to psychoanalyze you both or Freudian up it, but I gather maybe you had some shared trauma you might have, or you felt you were mining or getting in touch with when you were writing this together.
Names have been changed. Oh, no, they have not. No. Listen, Sarah and I met at drama school over 20 years ago, and I was, you know, pretty gritty, let's say, Dublin woman.
She was smoking rollies.
I was cool kid, and I had a lot of attitude. And Sarah was this, you know, bright-eyed, optimistic Canadian, and we were polar opposites. And I thought, you know, who is this woman? But then we found out pretty quickly that we had this very, very, very deep connection. And we bonded over a Leonard Cohen song, Famous Blue
Raincoat. Which Leonard Cohen song?
Famous Blue Raincoat.
The best one.
Well, one of the best. And I couldn't believe that this kind of bright-eyed woman that was so into Leonard Cohen, but you know.
He's our patron saint.
That's right.
Canada.
That's right. We became very, very close, and we realized we had this very deep connection. And, you know, it was connected to how we were raised in a lot of ways, you know, where there was
a shared experience.
Of
trauma and loss around addiction and we really, really bonded so deeply through that. And we, one thing we found that really got us both through, honestly, was humor. And there were many macabre things that happened in our upbringings that we both were able to see the humor in. And I think that's what sort of birthed the idea of the show of, you know, that we wanted to have this kind of tone that helped us to talk about these things, where there's a lightness and humor to the tone of talking about quite dark things.
But you know, when you meet someone who really gets you and you're telling them something quite dark, and then you're both just kind of end up
pissing yourself. Yeah. You're like, it is also so farcical and funny too. So I think that's what brought us together. Yeah.
Yeah. If it wasn't so tragic, it would be funny. So we kind of came from that space when we started trying to write together. We tried the other thing. We tried in theater school. We wrote a lot of, we wanted to be like Sarah Kane, and we did all of these projects that were, you know, generally involved a bathtub full of blood, and we destroyed like three floors of our historic, beautiful drama school. We got all the guys in our year to carry this like iron tub across the beautiful hardwood. And yeah, we tried to go dark on it, and it wasn't, we couldn't find the narrative. And I think that later we wanted to talk about certain themes. We came at them as narrative fiction, but with the themes that felt really deep to our hearts and our experience.
Yeah.
And also with all the, you know, when you go through something pretty traumatic, and maybe, you know, I was raised by my mom, and it's amazing when you kind of, we wanted to write something where you find your chosen family and celebrate that. And it doesn't, you don't have to define your life by the family you are born into, even though I have a great relationship with my family. So that's something we wanted to investigate.
Definitely. That's something that's really got us through our adult lives, really, is finding our chosen family. And we felt really lucky in our lives to have found that, and to kind of walk through life together and heal from all of these things together. Mm.
The action, as I mentioned in season two, moves to Toronto. And I watch this, I say this a lot, but it gives you a second opinion. I watched this with my wife, and she said, this is lovely. This is really funny. And I like season two more than season one, and take that as a compliment, because it made me laugh more. And there was as much heart as season one. But in season two, it's fair to say, Sarah, this is getting confusing. Very meta.
I'm a little lazy on the names there. they were supposed to be placeholders. Suddenly we were filming.
But tell me this, your character, Sarah, is kind of the messier one in the second one. And I don't know, that was a good yin and yang to the series. But you tell me, was that deliberate in the writing?
Yeah. Oh, great. I'm glad you felt that. It was deliberate. Yes. We felt like in season one, we wanted to explore this idea of, you know, Susan's life is a mess, and Sarah's coming into it full force. And whether Suze is willing to admit it or not, this person has this huge impact on her. And in between the seasons, in the 18 months that we don't see them, Suze does a really good job of getting her life together and living a kind of honest path. And this is something that Suze and I talk a lot about and are really interested in, is that you can't live according to somebody else's hymn sheet. And Suze is finally living a truly honest life and confronting all of her demons and really stepping up in her life. And when we find Sarah, she's got this veneer of everything's rosy and perfect, and she's getting married, but really it's all front for what's really going on, which is she's truly imploding. And I don't think I'm giving any spoilers here, with she's also battling some substances herself, with the apple not falling that far from the tree. And I think that we were trying to explore what happens when you live to someone else's code. She's kind of doing all the things in life that you're supposed to do and sleepwalking through the motions of life. And there's a real price to that. Susan and I can testify, we try to do things that way, and it doesn't generally work out. You have to find your own voice and your own path. And Suze has really found that. Even if you, like, we wanted to explore sort of the exterior of what, you know, one person might look like things are harder, but actually there's truth to how she's living.
Yeah, it's not perfect for Suze, but she's certainly taken the reins on her own life in season two. And that's all because of the impact Sarah had on her. And it's that thing of like, you need to find a way to live on your own terms. And I suppose that's the thesis of the show really in season two. And, you know, the Cheryl, Suze's mom, does it. And eventually, you know, the women do.
Yeah. And Suze, they're kind of helping Sarah this time find that path for herself. And we really wanted to explore that with Cheryl as well. And this idea of life on your own terms, and whatever themes we explore in the season, whether it's fertility or motherhood or marriage or the choice not to be a mother or or to travel or whatever it is, that it's life on your own terms.
And it's kind of, you know, we're trying to figure out like emancipation from the conditioning that we've all had, you know, because what's actually something that we desire, or what society has like bashed into us over so many years and generations.
Mm. And you mentioned Mother. Sophie Thomas is brilliant as Cheryl. She's one of the highlights in it. Susie, I said I wasn't going to Freudian this up, but here I go. But fertility is an issue in it. You've had your own journey in that regard, but a successful one by all accounts, if that's not the question.
Personal question. Not personal at all. That was very gentle, John, the way you phrased that. No, I love talking about this. Yes, I've been on my... I broke up with my partner when I was 40. And I was like, oh dear, not ideal. And I really wanted to become a mum, or try to figure out a way to become a mother. And so I went on my own solo journey to become a mom through IVF and with a donor. And it was, I was very lucky. It worked out very well. And now I have a 2-year-old daughter who is
the same age as my 2-year-old daughter, who are the real sisters season 2, whether they like it or not. We really forced them right into it.
And there's a nice little story in that Sarah came with me to my embryo transfer when I went to have my baby.
Wouldn't miss it.
And she was like, God, if this works, you know, we're going to have to hurry up if we want kids to be the same age. So she did. And yeah, six weeks later.
Lucky enough that it worked out.
It worked out. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a very happy story.
Yeah, something that, you know, Susie's been so bold and brave and done this completely on her own terms. And there's a long road there for women, whether they're deciding to do it or not do it. And and we both certainly went down both paths many times, and we're lucky to have come to the right choice for ourselves and been lucky enough to do it when we came to that decision. But it's
and it's not for the faint-hearted.
No, but
It's certainly worth it.
Well, listen, hats off to you. You have also, not to mix my metaphors, birthed a fantastic show. Season 2's finale will be on terrestrial TV next Thursday. You can watch the entire season of Season 2 of Sisters on the RTE player. I've been talking to its stars and indeed its writers and showrunners. They own it. They are everything in it. Susan Stanley and Sarah Goldberg. Guys, thanks a million and continued success.
Thanks, John.
Thanks so much, John. Great chatting to you.
I chose to find our father, which led me to her. I mean, she could have lived her whole life never even knowing I existed. The messenger always gets shot.
So you got out before she could shoot you?
Yeah.
Okay, let's say that I'm her, okay? What would you want to say to me?
Oh, no, I...
Yeah, come on, just try it. Just try it.
Okay, I'm sorry.
And what else?
And I... love you, and I need you in my life.
Feel better?
Yeah, you know, I actually do feel a little bit better.
I learned that in therapy. It's called a do-over.
You go to therapy?
Yeah, of course. Who doesn't?
A clip there from the very funny and sweet show, Sisters, a show full of heart. And you heard me talking to its creators, Sarah Goldberg and Susan Stanley. You can watch the entirety of Season 2 and indeed Season 1 on the RTE player, or you can watch the finale on the TV this Thursday night on RTE. Now, that is it for this week. Next week on the show, I'm going to be talking to Amanda Seyfried about her new movie, The Testament of Anne Lee. I'm also going to be talking to Oscar winner director Morgan Neville, who has just directed a brilliant new Paul McCartney documentary called Man on the Run. That's all to come next week. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can email screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend. Have a safe week ahead, and I will talk to you all next week.